Good afternoon. Welcome to the today's hearing. Today is Wednesday, January 28th. This is the Jobs, Growth, and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee. Representative Wagenius moves approval of the minutes from January 26th. Any discussion on the hearing? None. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Wagenius, did you have something else?
I did, if you would allow me to make a comment about the program last night that where you spoke.
Oh, well, if you're going to say nice things about me, I'll allow you to speak. Otherwise, no. No, Representative Wagenius, go ahead.
It was a good program, actually, and I understand this was at the History Center, and the CEO of XL spoke, and our chair was on a panel, and I thought it was really a good program, which lots of people had been there. One of the things that I learned last night from the CEO of XL was that if we had an all-electric or moved to substantially electric transportation, that would add 15% to their capacity. And I kept thinking about that as a win-win, given that we have this huge amount of air pollution issue in the metro. And if XL were creating this extra energy, it would be good for their ratepayers and for their stockholders. And so my question was, are you going to be doing some informational hearing on that subject? And particularly if anybody around here owns an electric.
Well, thanks, Representative Wagenius. Right now, we don't have all our committee schedule totally scripted for the year, but I think, you know, the chair has an interest in electric vehicles, and I'd like to share that interest with the committee and see if there's some seeing if people share my enthusiasm for it. I do remember when he said that the 15% figure, I am candidly a little bit confused by. I'd like to double check that. I think it would be much more. I mean, I look at my own personal experience. For example, last month, my house used a little bit over 1,000 kilowatt hours, and my car used 800 kilowatt hours. And so that just the math tells me that it would actually be much more than that. And so I think a bigger issue going forward, I have no doubt that electric vehicles are going to be, we're going to see those expanding in their usage. I think the bigger issue is making sure that we make it so punitive to plug cars in the middle of the day, for lack of a better word, that people are using it overnight. Because with our current rate structure, if people plug their cars in the middle of the day, they don't suffer the consequences of it. They just pay a regular retail rate. But as everyone knows, in the wholesale market behind the scenes, that power can be extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. Conversely, overnight, if those cars are plugged in, as we learned in the wind hearing, we sometimes have negative pricing. And actually soaking up that demand overnight would be a win-win, not just for electric car owners, but also for all ratepayers. And then, of course, the tertiary benefit is the fact that the energy that's produced overnight tends to be cleaner than the energy we have during the day. So the short answer, Representative Wagenius, is that the chair is very interested in that issue. I like it, I think. But as with most things, technology is going to be pushing us in that direction. We'll see where things go. But, yeah, I want to talk about it. So thanks for bringing it up. Appreciate it. All right, members, we have three items on our agenda. Is there anything else before we get started? There's three agenda items for the committee today. It's overview of the governor's budget and the Department of Labor Industry, Public Utilities Commission, as well as the Public Facilities Authority. And before first item we have is the Department of Labor and Industry, but before we do that, I want to have the PUC just come up for a second because there's an announcement that was made today that maybe the chair may want to, if you feel, I should have asked you before I told you I was going to do this, but maybe you want to make an announcement to the committee about an appointment you made to a certain board today, or I guess the governor did.
The
you
governor,
didn't do it.
Yeah.
But maybe make that announcement so members of the committee are aware of it.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. My name is Beverly Jones-Heidinger. I'm the chair of the Public Utilities Commission, and it was announced just within the last hour that the newest commissioner of the Public Utilities Commission is someone known to this body, and that's former Representative John Tuma. And he will be starting at the commission next Tuesday. So.
Oh, I thought it was supposed to be me. I'm sorry. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
I thought it was me.
Yeah.
Next year.
You're right. Right. No, don't get that rumor started. All right. So thank you very much. So former Representative Tuma, he'll be, I guess, Monday will be his first day in commission. So good. So thank you very much for taking that time. Commissioner Peterson. And members, we have an overview here from the Department of Labor Industry and okay, and then I think we're getting the budget pages passed out right now. So, thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, and I welcome the opportunity to give you an overview of our department as well as talk about our budget and briefly discuss our proposed change items in the governor's budget. And with me is Doug Julin, who has gotten the he's our financial director and is also going to run our slide today because it's technology is way over my head, and so Doug's going to do the ups and downs of that. On the first page, you can see we've passed out this in color folder. See, our mission is to ensure Minnesota's work and living environments are equitable, healthy, and safe, and we have five operating areas: workers' compensation, occupational safety and health, or OSHA, labor standards and apprenticeship, construction codes and licensing, and general support. It's worthwhile to recall or to understand that we have 160,000 work sites in Minnesota. That means there are roughly 160,000 places where people work. And our responsibility is to make sure that they're safe for the people who work there and the people are getting paid equitably. And that if they're hurt, they get fair compensation for it. We have about, right now, you probably all know, there's somewhere between 2.8 to 2.9 million people working, employed in Minnesota. So we're doing pretty well, as I think as we all recognize that Minnesota, at least in terms of its overall employment record, is doing reasonably well right now, though there are problems, which I'm sure you'll talk about over time. The next page is just our organizational deal. You can see the commissioner and the deputy commissioner is Jessica Luman, and our assistant commissioner, Chris Liefeld, is in charge of workers' compensation. One of the things that I've tried to do as I've been in the department is I'm personally pretty cheap, and so I think that we should operate pretty cheaply. And so we haven't filled some of the jobs. We've tried to, we're supposed to have another assistant commissioner. I've never done that. So I've asked, Jessica is now a deputy commissioner, but she's also serves as assistant commissioner over construction codes and licensing. Each of us do a little more supervision. The OSHA people report directly to me and things like that. We just try to make it run as smoothly, but as least expensively as possible. I try to take a great point of pride in that. I think that works better for all of us. That means we have less laying around time and more time working doing the job. Then the next page is our revenues. We have interesting composition of revenues. Only about 1% of the department comes from the general fund. The rest is funded out of a number of different various funds, which I'll quickly go through. The workers' compensation fund is the biggest one, as you can see in the biennium, the biennium we're going in right now, that brought in like somewhere around $164 million. That's a lot of that goes into operations, which I'll describe later, but a big part of it goes to pay for various workers' compensation benefits for people who are old, and I'll discuss those. But it's paid for by an assessment, and that assessment is going down over time. It's now the assessment on both self-insured companies, that's about 20 or 25% account for it, and the other 75 to 80% is on insured people. And basically on the insured, if you have a small business or any business, and you typically, you would pay the average rate payer and premium payer pay about 3.8% of her or his premium would go to pay this assessment. And this is going down, and I'll explain that later, but it is going down, and it will be going down substantially over the next 10 or 20 years. And or if you're self-insured, you're paying around 20%, 19.8% of your wage loss benefits. That is, if say you're Toro, and you have $100,000 worth of injuries that year, and you pay out $100,000 in wage loss benefits, and you're self-insured, you would pay into the fund $19,800, 19.8%. And if you're a Toro and you had no injuries, for some reason, you had absolutely no workers' comp injuries, you wouldn't be paying anything into that fund. That's just the way that's set up by the law. That's how it works. The other funds that are there are the construction codes and licensing is the biggest one. I'll go in more detail on that. That is basically from fees that we get for inspections and permitting. The next largest one is federal money, which we get for the OSHA programs, which I'll describe later on. That's around $10 million. Contract recovery fund is basically a pass-through, $6 million. That this has been arranged and worked out with the contractors of the state through their associations, paying in lieu of bonding. What a registered licensed contractor would do, will pay into the fund, and then if for some reason there's a judgment brought against them for a failure in their work that they've done something incorrectly or something with the home, and the homeowner is able to get a judgment against them for up to $75,000, they can go into that fund and get reimbursed for it. And so and all the registered licensed contractors in the state pay into that, and then so it's like an insurance policy. I think we have one or two people that work on running it. But it is a, as you can see, it's $6 million bucks. Then Workforce Development Fund, that comes from unemployment stuff, that covers our apprenticeship and a few other programs we have. That's less than 1%, $2.3 million. General funds, $2.5 million. And I think that covers our where we get our money. On the next page is the expenditures by program. And what this is, well, the biggest one there, once again, is workers' comp benefits. There's three major benefits, which I'll go into more detail, but there's supplemental benefits is one of them, second injury benefits, and also for uninsured employer benefits. The supplemental benefits and the second injury benefits were benefits which were done away with in the mid-1990s during some reform of the workers' comp laws in the state. However, there are still workers who were injured prior to that time are still covered, are still entitled to those benefits because the policy, the laws in effect when they are injured. So they're still receiving those benefits, and they'll continue to receive them until, you know, they're no longer eligible until they die or whatever it is. So that's where the lion's share of our assessment comes from. And I'll go into a little more detail. The lion's share of our assessment goes to pay for those benefits owed to those workers who were injured before 1995 is what happened, maybe 1996. I don't recall which ones. Then if you go into the other areas, construction codes and licensing, that also includes the contract recovery fund. And it's basically a fee for service. You need a permit. You have to have an electrical permit for something you're doing on your house. The inspector comes out, takes a look at it, you pay for it. And also for licenses, if you have a high pressure piping license, you pay your license fee and you get reimbursed. You have, that goes in that fund and pays for our work in handling that. OSHA is $22 million, and that's part federal, part state, roughly 50-50 for the program. The Workers' Comp Administrative is not only that covers administrative stuff that the department does, which is we'll talk in more detail, but also covers some of the OSHA. No, I'm sorry. The OSHA funds, half the OSHA funds come out of the workers' comp funds too. The idea is that if you have effective OSHA, if you have an effective OSHA, your workers' comp fees will be less. And that was passed, approved sometime in the late 1990s, early 2000s, I believe. And the workers' comp just is the work we do there. General support. General support is basically a tax the department does on other. Our lawyers, our accounting, financial services, other people in the central office, that we tax other operations in the department. So it's just the internal transfers. And then apprenticeship and labor standards account for 2% of our total thing. And $4.5 million there. Now I'll talk about the specific departments, and then I'll be able to give you more details of what I'm talking about in the various things. We have 121 employees in the workers' comp division and the operating budget about $10.5 million per year. And what basically it administers the work comp system. It doesn't do anything to work with insurance, but basically keeps all the records, receive what's called first reports of injuries, which you get hurt in the job, or if your employee gets hurt in the job, you submit one of those things, and then make sure that if there's a dispute, the disputes are handled, and keeps track of the files and moves things along. We also provide mediation services and audit files on an ongoing basis so people are not out of their... don't get underpayment. And that's divided into five different areas: the special compensation fund, which collects the money, which runs our funding system, compliance records and training, that does the auditing of all the files. Alternative dispute resolution. There we have lawyers, former judges, mediators, trying to resolve issues, trying to get warring parties together and resolve the issues so they don't have to go to a trial. And then we provide folk rehab services, and we have a two-person office and ombudsman, which a small business person or injured worker can call if they're having problems if they don't understand what's going on. And the office, the ombudsman, will help them out. And that's worked out very well. The next page is the workers' compensation fund. There, you can see our supplementary benefits account for 3,000 claimants. And that's $76 million a year. The second injury benefits are $19 million a year. I don't think you need, because these benefits are done away with, it doesn't do you any good to even understand what they're all about, because these people are entitled to them, and we're not changing them at all. It's just, as time goes on, they'll go away. Then the next one, those $20 million for workers' compensation benefits paid to employees, uninsured and bankrupt self-insured employees. That is, you have a business, or you're working for a business. The business doesn't buy coverage. Doesn't get, for one reason they're supposed to, by law you're supposed to, but they don't buy it, and you get hurt, and so someone's got to pay for it. So it comes out of this fund, and or your business goes bankrupt. And it's a self-insured business. We have several major ones we're still dealing with from years ago, and so that comes out of this fund. And so that's part of the assessment that goes against the individual employer, pays into this to cover others. So we try to make sure that people aren't lightly self-insured, that we know that they have enough money to cover it, and we go way out of our way to make sure everybody buys coverage for workers' comp, because it's just the other people, the good people are obeying the laws are paying for those that are trying to avoid the law in this situation. Then we also... We support the OSHA activities, and funds for three different agencies come out of the workers' comp fund too. That's for Office of Administrative Hearings. They have like 19 or 20 judges who do nothing but work comp hearings, the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, and the Department of Commerce, which does fraud investigations on the money we give them. And you can see that's $1.5 million every 2 years.
Commissioner, at this point, we thank you to the staff for getting the copies of the budget changes. I think if we could we move forward to the budget changes that are contained in your presentations?
Okay.
And then I'll bring in, I know there's some good news in there, too, so we can cover that.
So we'll just stop with the good news, okay? That be okay, Mr. Chairman?
Sounds good to me.
The first item, we have, I think, four or five pretty small budget changes, except for the first one is a substantial one. That is, we want to reduce our CCLD, Construction Code and Licensing Division fees, or license costs.
It's in the back.
It's about five pages in the back. Page 15.
Representative Mahoney, if you look up on the screen above you, it's one that looks like that. Let's wait a second here until everyone's...
Should be about the seventh page in from the back.
Please continue, Commissioner.
The just as the DNR's funds for their snowmobiling funds depend on the weather. This year, I'm sure the DNR is not making a lot of money in their snowmobile fund. Last year, they probably did pretty well. The CCLD fund depends on the construction economy. If the construction economy is doing poorly, like we was in 2009, 2010, and part of 2011, this fund goes way down. When the construction economy is doing well, the fund goes way up. Right now it's doing very well, and we have more money than we need. So we'd like to come in and just simply ask you to authorize a cut in the license fees for construction contractors, electricians, plumbers, high-pressure pipe fitters, boiler operators, and we don't need the money. And if we don't need the money, we shouldn't use it. And in 2 years from now, if we need the money, we'll come back and ask for it, or we'll ask to continue this cut. I don't think we should be carrying extra money.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner Peterson, are you asking to reduce the fees on a permanent basis or on a temporary basis?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, temporary basis, 2 years.
So, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner, you wouldn't have to come back and ask for an increase in the fees in 2 years. They would just automatically go back to what they are today.
Commissioner.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Chairman. I want to go back to where you talked about the workers' compensation fiscal fund and you would the benefits paid to employees of uninsured employers. And you've got a $20 million figure on here, but don't in fact they go after those employers to recover? And does that show up on your revenue chart somewhere?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we'll get you the information on how much we recover, but that's what's left over after we go after them. We do go after them, but that's what's left over. So we end up owing.
Representative Luna.
If you're out of business, you're out of business, you have no money. We do go after them, though. We spend a lot of time. We have two or three lawyers spend full time doing that.
Seeing no other questions, Commissioner, please continue.
So that's our first. This would be about $3 million savings to people pay licenses into us. And you can see the numbers as well as I can. The entry, the one year level is just a person as an apprentice, or maybe someone only wants to work one more year, $29 to $14. Journeyperson, 2 year license, $75 to $48, that's a 36% cut. Master is $119 to $88, and a contractor, $207 to $168. And, we think it'll work well for us, we can make sense. The next one is replace our legacy computer system. 20 years ago, the department purchased a computer system based on what's called, it's an outdated technology called Power Builder. And today it's become harder and harder for us to find software to work with it, even to find individuals skilled in replacing it. Last year we brought up a guy from Texas, the only one we could find, he spent a year here. And the poor guy, this is an aside, the poor guy, he'd never been in snow at all. And last year he had the most miserable, he had the most miserable winter in 10 or 20 years. And you'd see him walk in the office every day, and he just had this pained look, I want to get out of here. Anyway, that is one of the problems we have with the system. If you're going to think of where we were in technology in 1995 and where we are today, so we can't use a lot of the same emails, the submissions of records, sending out emails, or sending out records, accepting records. We just can't do everything we need to do. And so we want to replace it. Our preliminary estimate is it's going to cost $3 million a year for the next 4 years. The total cost will be $12 million. However, we have a consultant that's working on this, and this is the problem we have, that we don't know what the real cost estimate is going to be. We won't know for another 6 weeks or 2 months. So I'm going to be asking you, put in $3 million. We may come back and ask you, but we'd wait until we had the authorization from the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council that they would go along with it and make sure it'd be okay. If the numbers don't add up, we'll just come back next year or the following year. We need to take care of this, but if we don't take care of it for another year, we can get by. Same time, it does need to be done. We need to do this work.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, are you a part of Minute then or not? And if not, well, how come not?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson. We're not part of Minute, but our services are provided by Minute. Minute will be doing the work. They'll be hiring Minute contracts with the consultants to tell us what we need to provide. And then Minute will contract with whomever provides the new computer system. The employees that we have working on the computer system are Minute employees. we give, I think we pay Minute something like $4 million a year for their employees. So for those of you who don't know what Minute is just the technology support system for the state. All the people who work on computers in the state are supposedly are members, are employed by Minute. And it's just an enterprise-wide agency that just provides the computer services for the state.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Commissioner, when you replace this legacy computer system, will that mean that the hospitals and the insurers will have to finally, after 10 years of being in law that they have to, will they finally start doing electronic billing? Or will one of the two come up with another excuse for not doing it? Just wondering.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we're going to be bringing in a bill within a few weeks calling for give us more authority on electronic transactions. Hopefully, we'll be able to go after them before we get this thing done. We certainly will be, there'll be fewer excuses available for anybody for not being able to work this system if we had this one done. We appreciate the question.
Mr. Representative Mahoney.
And seeing how it's something I struggled with, I think someone else struggled with it before. I suspect it's going to lay in your lap, but as a technology guy, you should be a little offended at the fact that the two groups that spend about $200 million a year can't come up with an agreement to use electronic billing. Maybe you can convince them, because my other friend and I were not able.
And maybe they could fix the MinSure website, too, while they're at it. Too soon. Sorry. Too soon. I'm sorry. Any other questions for the commissioner? I'll continue, Commissioner. Thank you.
Yeah, we're asking, the next increase would be asking for the Workforce Development Fund, $250,000 a year to hire two new apprenticeship representatives. The apprenticeship program, it's a great program. What it does is you earn while you're learning. You're not doing, it combines on-the-job training with some schooling at the same time. 80% of our apprentices in the state are in construction, 20% aren't. Right now we've got 9,000 apprentices. There are a number of bills, number of ideas out there to work on more dual training issues, which is apprenticeship is, and Representative O'Neill will be offering one soon, I understand. And apprenticeship is just part of that scheme, that whole idea of trying to get improve our workforce. It's not going to change everybody's life, but a good apprenticeship can really make a difference in some individual's life and allow them to make a pretty good living. It ends up, the apprenticeship program, you finish the apprenticeship program and you end up with a certificate that you can show that you can do the job.
Representative Luna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner, with the computer upgrade, is there any talk of capability of coordinating with the IRS? If you've got a $20 million problem with unrecovered funds for companies that are operating illegal and we're catching them after the fact, where on their tax return they're taking in a deduction for employee expenses, and that number doesn't match up with what we show as a payroll figure on our application or our audit for work comp. If the two numbers don't match, then we give them a call.
Mr. Chairman, I hope so. That sounds great. Hope we can do it. The better information we get, the better off we are.
Commissioner, your next budget change item is my favorite one. This is the fee adjustment for the Office of Combative Sports. And am I here to understand that the Dayton administration supports men beating each other up more often in the state of Minnesota? Is that your position, Commissioner?
In the Dayton administration, we're heavy hitters.
Ah, good. Well done.
Or we're trying to, Mr. Chairman, we're trying to reduce the chokehold. Anyway, we're asking for a $2 million, Mr. Chairman, we're asking for a $2 million, or $2,000, not $2 million. These are pretty small license fees. The department regulates, through our Office of Combative Sports, we regulate professional boxing and amateur and professional mixed martial arts. And it's a pretty small operation. It's less, I think, our funds around $100,000 or something like that. Anyway, we want to reduce the fees, the licensing fees for professional boxers and MMA combatants from $100 to $70, and from amateur MMA people from $60 to $50. And I know this is one that's near and dear to your heart, Mr. Chairman. I hope you're able to get this passed. What the problem is, I don't mean to be too came. The problem is our fees are too high, and we're having so it's made it more. We compete in a sense for fights with the Indian reservations and Wisconsin and Iowa, at least in some cases. This just makes it a little cheaper.
Sure, Representative Szczesinski.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your presentation. Just I somehow remembered, wasn't it 4 years ago we were asked to raise this?
Commissioner,
Mr.
Pearson.
Chairman. Representative Szczesinski, yes, we screwed up.
Okay.
We made it too high, and now we're coming back to say, okay, we were wrong.
The member from Southern Manitoba, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Commissioner Peterson. This is probably a rhetorical question, but I would contend that if you went out and talked to the business people in my community and the schools and so forth, you have a whole list of fees that are too high. I apologize for coming in late. I haven't seen all of your presentation. I'm wondering if you have a summary of other fees that you are recommending that we reduce.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, what I don't think our fees are too high. We have to support the work that the legislature tells us to do, so we do them. And if we have licensing fees, we have inspections we have to have done. If we're spending, in this case, I think we're collecting too much, so I think we ought to cut them back. Same time, if we cut them back too much, we wouldn't be able to provide the services which you've told us to provide.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just my last point would be, you made mention when you were talking about this fee structure adjustment that you were comparing them to other states. Do you have any information that compares your other fee structures to what other states charge for similar activities that you could bring to the committee?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we don't have it right with. We'll get it to you. But it's a good question. Thank you. We'll get it. Thank
you. Commissioner, if you could supply it to the committee legislative assistance,
yep.
That way all members
we'll
of the committee
here.
Have that. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question. Since we're involved in this now, I just heard recently report that some of the wrestlers who are governed by the World Wrestling Association, whatever they are now suing because of concussions and things like that. Are we in, is the state now in this role and liable for any of that kind of problem in the future?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I don't think we're liable. It's obviously a great concern to us, though, that if we don't want anybody to get hurt, we have a doctor at every match. Ambulances are close by. These are sports which are, in some cases, going to be dangerous to people. We agree. People do wave. The promoters are liable. But generally, the combatants, the fighters do, is just simply waive any rights they would have against the promoter. It's just the way, of course, the way the business is run nationally and internationally. But it can be, I mean, boxing in particular, it's aimed at the idea of knocking someone out, hitting the head so they fall down. And that can be a dangerous interaction. There's no question about it. So we want to run it as safely as possible.
Commissioner, is professional wrestling under the Office of...
Mr. Chairman, no.
It's not?
No.
Okay. Your last change item is the operational adjustment?
Right. This is just one that you'll be hearing from every agency. 1.8%, the governor's asked for a 1.8% increase for covering increased operational costs, salaries, travel, whatever else it is. Lease costs, that's right. And that's, in our case, that we would, some would be funded out of the general fund, some out of the workers' compensation fund, some out of the workforce development fund, and we would just take it out of the CCLD fund, which is a pay. You don't need to appropriate from the CCLD fund, the Construction Code Licensing Division.
Commissioner, thanks for your presentation. Are there any other member questions from members of the committee? Look forward. Representative Gunther.
I have one question for the commissioner. You still go to some of these fights?
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther. Yeah.
Representative Gunther.
This is a commission that gets right into it. I really believe that.
Maybe we can have like you and Representative Gunther and the commissioner, you guys can have like a charity UFC fight in the octagon or something. Commissioner, thanks a lot for being here today. We greatly appreciate it, and I look forward to staying in touch with you throughout the session.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, members.
Next is our overview and Governor budget recommendations from the Public Utilities Commission. We're honored to have the commissioner as well as the executive secretary and the Public Utilities Commission to join us. And they already gave us copies of their budget changes, right? Or is it just the same? Okay. And members, in your packets, you already have the governor's recommended budget for the Public Utilities Commission as well as the presentation. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Beverly Jones Heidinger, and I'm the chair of the Public Utilities Commission. And with me today is Dan Wolf, the newly appointed executive secretary, and also with us is Marcia Battle Jenks, the woman behind all the numbers. So if we get deep in the weeds, Marcia's here to help us out. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I am going to take just a few minutes, since there are some new members to the committee, to give a brief overview of the Public Utilities Commission and our budget. And just so that you are familiar with us, there are five commissioners on the Public Utilities Commission. We are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. We have staggered six-year terms. No more than three of the five members can be of one political party. And at least one of our members must come from outside the metropolitan area. These are certainly full-time positions. We'll talk more about how we spend our time. And we can only be removed for cause from our position once we've been appointed. I think that the easiest way to think of us is that we do operate like court. The matters that come before us are developed through an evidentiary record. The documents are filed in an electronic docket system, where they are available for anyone, including parties and members of the public, to see all of the same information that we see. One difference is that we also operate pursuant to the open meeting law. So all of our deliberations are conducted in public and pursuant to notice and open meeting with a published agenda. Like a court, parties and other members of the public are not permitted to communicate with us directly concerning matters that are pending before us. Any communication with us must be through the ordinary process and filed in that electronic docket system so that the communications are available to all. We have a very transparent process in that there is an electronic docket system. It's available to anyone to read all of the same documents that I see relative to making a decision, and with some minimal protections for certain trade secret information that the utilities may file with us. We do invite public comment. It can be submitted in writing or electronically, and then it becomes part of the docket that is before us and, again, available to all. Our decisions are made by a vote in an open meeting. They are memorialized in a written decision. Our decisions are appealed directly to the Court of Appeals. So in all of those respects, we are very much like a court. Our mission is established by statute, and that's to assure safe, adequate, and reliable service at fair and reasonable rates consistent with the state's environmental policies. We regulate investor-owned utilities for electricity and natural gas. We have virtually no jurisdiction over the municipal and co-op delivery of electricity and gas. A little bit, but very little. We also determine the need for and the location of what's defined in statute as large energy facilities. This includes large transmission lines, large power generation, large oil pipelines, and wind farms, large solar developments that exceed 50 megawatts, and so forth. We also have some very limited regulation over landline telephone service. That's shrunk considerably over the years, but it is still a small and important part of what we do. Turning to our regulatory operations, we do receive about 1,400 filings a year from the public utilities that we regulate on a wide variety of topics, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. We also have a very small but effective consumer office that responds to about 4,000 consumer complaints closed each year. And we have an individual who serves the role as a public advisor. Because we have a lot of proceedings where the public is interested, we designated this position through the funds we received in the last biennium to assure that it was one member of the staff who could attend public hearings and was available to explain how to participate in the proceedings that we have, how to submit comments, and how to access our electronic docket system for those who are interested in doing that. Just to give you a taste of the dockets that we address, I've tried to highlight a few here that may, some of which I'm sure you're aware of, and others perhaps not so much. It is a responsibility given to us, along with the Department of Commerce, to implement the laws enacted in 2013 to impose new solar standards and new solar requirements throughout the state, and also to offer the opportunity for consumers who wish to buy shares in community solar gardens to do that by setting up the construct and the rates that are paid for those. So we do approve the methodology for calculating the rates to be paid for solar and many other issues raised by those laws, as well as to look at the power purchase agreements utilities choose to make with independent solar developers to provide solar to the system. We approve investments to address aging gas infrastructure and improve pipeline safety. We are not the regulators of pipeline safety. Those standards and inspections are conducted by the Office of Pipeline Safety, but it is our responsibility to review the costs of that aging infrastructure replacement and assure that the funds are collected back from the ratepayers efficiently and in a timely way. The legislature authorized the utilities to go ahead and make some of those investments and be directly compensated for them without having to file their next rate case in order to assure that there are no artificial impediments to replacing that aging infrastructure. I think I'm doing that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Please
just
continue.
Briefly to return to that, I think everyone is aware that pipeline safety is very important and that any kind of an explosion in a natural gas pipeline can have devastating consequences. So we did not want to, we want to assure that there's no impediment to replacement of those lines which are failing safety tests. The next item.
Okay, so unhook one of them. No, unhook the other one. So if that happens again, let's just take that mic and unplug it. The one closest to you, right, Representative Simonson? That was the one? Thanks. Commissioner.
All right, thank you. Next, I would mention that we have had complaints filed with us about rural telephone call completion, and we have opened an investigation in order to attempt to determine what the cause of that those call failures are in the rural parts of the state. We also have an open investigation of whether landline telephone service has been transferred to companies beyond the state's jurisdiction without the approval of the commission. So there are a number of telephone matters that still come before us in spite of the fact that most of the rate regulation has been eliminated. In addition, we have been asked to initiate a rulemaking proceeding to determine whether there's sufficient competition throughout the state to eliminate the quality of service standards, and that process is just underway. Electric transmission lines need in location. Some of you may be familiar with the CapEx project, which was a billion-dollar project jointly initiated by all of the IOUs in Minnesota as well as Great River to upgrade the infrastructure of the electric transmission system. Almost all of those lines are now operational or close to operational. The investments are being collected from the ratepayers, and we are already seeing great benefits to enhancing that backbone to the transmission system. That will continue to unroll over the next couple of years. most of this electric transmission line development and planning is conducted in association with the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, colloquially known as MISO. I don't know how familiar all of you are with this, but it essentially operates the high voltage transmission system for 13 states and the province of Manitoba to assure electrical reliability throughout the region, regardless of whether certain lines come offline, certain generation comes offline, to assure we have a robust system without system congestion. This assures that the rates for electric service remain as competitive and low as possible. There is a MISO regional office here in Eagan, Minnesota. For those of you who haven't had the opportunity to visit it but would like to do so, I'm sure they would welcome you to see the NASA-like screen display that shows the voltage on all the high-voltage transmission lines throughout that region and what we call the locational marginal price. That is the price that electricity is being sold for throughout the system at any given moment. It's a real-time system. It also shows at any point what the amount of wind generation in the system is. All of this is very helpful to us as we look at transmission planning and evaluate the resources that the investor-owned utilities are planning for serving Minnesota customers. On the next page, you'll see that we do approve new electric generation. We've just completed a competitive resource acquisition process where we directed Xcel Energy, because it anticipated it was going to need more power, to go out and conduct a competitive bid process rather than simply construct their own generating plant. That process is nearly complete and led to the selection of some solar and two natural gas generation plants that will come online between now and 2019. One point I guess I should make in that context is nothing happens quickly in the utility business because these are large infrastructure investments. They take a tremendous amount of engineering planning as well as policy planning. They are very costly. And so we are looking now at generation that will be coming online in that 2019-2020 horizon. We do require integrated resource plans from all the investor-owned utilities. Those are filed every 3 years, and they project how much customer demand they expect over the coming 15-year period, as well as the resources that they intend to either add or take offline to meet those goals, as well as the environmental objectives that the state has set. We do also approve the need for and the routes for oil pipelines. Because of the development of shale oil production in North Dakota and oil sands production in Canada, we've seen an increase in the number of applications for oil pipelines through the state of Minnesota, and we do review both the need for those and the routes once the need is determined. The process and the timeline for doing that are set forth in statute, and each one requires a different type of permitting process and environmental review. Like all of our decisions, these decisions are made on the record. There is the opportunity for public input. There is an evidentiary hearing where the witnesses for all points of view are cross-examined. An administrative law judge issues a report to us. Parties have an opportunity to file any exceptions and to make oral argument to us before, in, again, a public meeting. We take a vote on those determinations and issue written decisions, which are appealable to the Court of Appeals. Additional issues that are coming before us, consumer energy use data. Over the last 4 or 5 years, there's been increasing interest in getting more information about how individual customers use their electricity and how we might take advantage of that to promote energy efficiency and also more distributed generation. This is a tricky balance for us because we're very concerned about the privacy of the customers, residential customers, and the use of energy in their own homes, but also for commercial and industrial customers. They often have a very important privacy, trade secret interest in the data that's generated about their own electricity use. So we have an open docket where we're attempting to further consider those interests and try to find the appropriate balance. We also are increasingly faced with the challenges of cybersecurity. For those of you who may have heard presentations from utilities, you know that literally every day there are thousands of attempts to hack into our public utilities through the internet, and that they are constantly challenged to be sure that they are isolating their systems as necessary so they're not connected in ways where intrusion in one part could affect the other. They are constantly upgrading their system. They are constantly, I think as Mr. Folks mentioned from Excel, all of a sudden he's got lots of meetings with people who have eagles in their logos, and that is true. The Department of Homeland Security, the Secret Service on occasion, the Department of Energy, all are working very closely with our utilities to help notify them of potential threats. And from our point of view, we're in no position to evaluate the technical aspects of their cybersecurity. And fortunately, there are other organizations that do that. But we want to be sure of two things. First, that if they're having to spend money in order to do that, that we know what's being spent and for what reasons, and that there's some kind of limitations placed on that that are prudent. But moreover, too, that they are working with the agencies that do have the technical expertise to assure that every step is being taken that can be to protect the reliability of our system. A major outage through a cyber attack could have devastating impact not only on people's lives, but certainly on the economy of the state. And so we do meet with the utilities regularly to review their cyber preparation plans.
Commissioner, this is a good time. Representative Metza has been very patient. He's had a question for a while here. It's a good break for you to grab a drink if you want or something. So, Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, I know you had talked about having regulation over landline phone systems. Is there any reason that we still do that when we have VoIP cell phones and so many other communication platforms? And could you explain why they would still fall in that criterion, seeing as they have the burden of upkeeping all the lines that all the other companies license and use, and then don't have the same regulation, in my mind anyway, as the other companies?
I think, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that we have seen decreasing, certainly, regulation over those landlines, and that's why we are going to be looking at how much competition is there. I believe that there are parts of the state where there is a lot of competition, but we still have some parts of the state where there's no or very little competition. Those tend to be people who either don't have access to other forms of telephone communication or they can't afford it. And landline is still the least expensive option for those people. So we want to be sure that there is, in fact, a robustly competitive market in all parts of the state, and that's why we've opened this investigation.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious on the landline. In my part of the state, one day I picked up the phone and I was calling the superintendent of schools in Lancaster, Minnesota. The phone rang twice and it went dead. And I thought, what's going on here? So I thought, well, I did something wrong. I'm using my landline in my office, so I dialed the number again. The phone rang twice, and it went dead. So I used my cell phone, and I was able to get through with that, calling his cell phone. And he said, yeah, that's a problem that we have up here. Those calls are not being routed. Well, then I managed to contact a large, small by our standards maybe, but a large company in my area in Carlstead, Minnesota, and talked to the owner of that business, and he told me because of the calls not being placed through, they've lost several million dollars worth of revenue in just 1 year. Their phone calls went from several hundred a day to like a dozen, and they've got these different graphs that show that. So I'm curious to know, you said that you investigate and that you have an ongoing investigation, if I heard you correctly.
Yes.
Where is that investigation at this time, and how long has it been going on, and how long do you think it will be before there's some sort of resolution?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian. We opened that investigation within the last 6 months. I can't tell you precisely. But we did it exactly for the reasons that you mentioned. We had testimony from a company in northern Minnesota that has been seriously affected by this. And we are aware of the problem. The telephone companies, let me just say this, the large carriers and the small carriers are frequently joined by what we call intermediate carriers. And some of those intermediate carriers are paid to handle a certain volume. And the theory is, and this is what we're trying to find out, that when they've met that volume for that time period in which they're being paid, that they start to drop calls because they don't believe they're being compensated for it. And that's what we're trying to find out. Who are those intermediate carriers? That's the first part of the investigation. We've asked the telephone companies to tell us who their intermediate carriers are. What kind of arrangements do they have with them? How is that playing out at the local telephone company level? And, you know, this kind of goes to the resources of the state versus the resources of those telephone companies. We are doing what we can with the assistance of the Department of Commerce to ask those questions and to collect that information and to try to analyze it and to try to determine exactly what the cause is of those dropped calls and who's responsible for them. Then, yes, I think we have the authority to take action and impose penalties if necessary to assure that the calls are being completed. But it goes back to the same question about, is there adequate competition? In some parts of the state, for certain, there is. In other parts of the state, you know, the landline company is a little bit at the mercy of these larger carriers.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Madam Chair, thank you for the answer. You know, it's one thing if I'm trying to call the superintendent of schools in Lancaster, but if somebody else is trying to place a call through 911,
right,
emergency services for an ambulance or law enforcement, and all of a sudden we've taken this to a whole different level. And I certainly hope that we come to a quick resolution. I've had one of the large carriers in my office, and a couple of years ago it's been going on since then, and there's great frustration with this problem up in that part of the state. So thank you.
Commissioner, do you want to follow up on that?
Just if I may, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, I want to be clear that the 911 system operates a little bit independently of this. We have experienced some problems with the 911 system, but I do not believe that they're connected to this call completion issue. It's a slightly different matrix that's being used to place those calls. So that would also be a major concern to us. And you may be aware there was a 911 failure for a short period of time a few months ago, and the FCC is taking a very close look at what happened there. Fortunately, it had less impact here in Minnesota than it did in some states, but it's a very important concern to us and to the FCC as well.
Thank you. Commissioner, or each of the intermediaries and all along the phone chain, is everyone cooperating and giving you the information you need?
Mr. Chair, we don't regulate them, and I don't know. I don't know yet. We'll find out, I guess, when the Department of Commerce reports back to us.
Fabian, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and the intermediaries can be located literally anywhere in the world. They can be in someone's basement in Waco, Texas, or an attic in London. So, yeah. You know, am I correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Commissioner, so... But we don't know whether they're being cooperative or not, is the answer.
Mr. Chair, I don't know at this point whether they're being cooperative.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, just a kind of a general question, kind of from the regulatory standpoint and implementation. As far as the way the board looks at things, I know it's very judicious and the way it looks kind of at each project and things. Just kind of a theoretical question to you, kind of what criteria could potentially stop a project that's over 50 megawatts. So, you know, where you are solely responsible, you know, there are no locals may be involved in the project. You know, what would put things forward that would be, from an evidence-based standpoint, would you guys kind of, on the weight side of things, what would potentially be kind of a project stopper?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. The criteria that we apply are set forth in statute. And so for the need determination or identified, you know, what's the need for it? Are there other alternatives that could provide it either at lower cost or with less environmental impact? What's the social and economic impact of the project and a number of other criteria that we take a look at? Similarly, if the need has been determined and there is a siting for the particular facility or the siting of the route for a line, pipeline, or transmission line, similarly, there are a long list of criteria that we apply to determine, you know, how much disruption is it going to be to people's homes and businesses, what is the impact on local infrastructure, parks, hospitals, schools, what's the impact on protected areas, other transmission lines or pipelines, road crossings. MnDOT is usually quite heavily involved in our proceedings to make sure the routing doesn't interfere with their planning, and so forth. So those criteria are quite clearly set forth in statute, and we'd be happy to share those with you.
Sounds good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Commissioner, we got one more slide, so why don't we let you, or you got more than one slide. Maybe I will ask my question. So the certificate of need process, as I understand it, is that because we have dedicated service territories in Minnesota, we want to make sure that utilities aren't accidentally incentivized to overbuild because they can get that rate recovery for it. And so the role of the PUC in the certificate of need process is to make sure to represent the ratepayers to make sure that infrastructure, I'm summarizing a complex issue, but that's what the purpose of it is. For those areas where projects are designed to deliver a commodity or deliver service to other states or outside of our region, what role does the Public Utilities Commission play in that certificate of need process?
Mr. Chair, again, those questions are addressed in the statute both for electric transmission lines and for pipelines. For pipelines, essentially the question is there a market for the product such that the pipe will be subscribed, and is this the most effective way to deliver the product? So there's a comparison made of truck versus rail versus pipeline and so forth, and the route that's going to follow. For electric transmission lines, it's both to serve locally, but the statute also allows and expects that we will cooperate with the MISO region and the MISO footprint in order to overall increase the reliability of the electric grid and help keep costs within our region low. So in both cases, there's different criteria, but they are spelled out in statute.
And so it's not a fair question for the commissioners, but maybe a question for legislators to look into, is that in an area where we have private sector investment in energy infrastructure, where the costs of that are not borne by captive ratepayers or even necessarily by Minnesotans, if private sector money is on the line, you know, why did the state of Minnesota require a certificate of need process? That's, again, it's not a question for you, it's more for members of the committee. That in that situation, the risk is being borne by investors if they don't utilize that infrastructure and they don't get enough subscribers, it's not the taxpayer's responsibility, it's the private sector investors. And that's a question maybe we should be asking ourselves, is why we do that. Because again, as you said, this, the PUC, you enforce the rules that we tell you to do. So
we try to do that.
That's good.
Representative Garofalo, let me just add too that I you know, it is a good question. I think one of the other questions though is if you have infrastructure that then gets what's the word I'm looking for? No longer needed, then you know, there it sits. And so I think there is an intent to also be sure that there is actually a need and a projected need over, you know, this infrastructure hangs around for a long time. And so if it's forsaken, shall we say, that also puts a burden on the state of Minnesota. So there is that additional element to the determination.
And maybe a fiscal assurance is a better way of doing that than dumping the stuff on your guys' lap. But it's a conversation for members to consider. But if you could please continue with your presentation.
Thank you. I think I already touched a little bit on regional gas and electric coordination, so I won't talk too much more about that. But this is an increasingly important part of our job to follow what's going on at MISO, to follow what's going on with the Environmental Protection Agency and with the federal agency that sets reliability standards. They have dozens of dockets, and we have very limited ability to continue to stay on top of that and make sure that Minnesota's interests are protected in those proceedings. And Mr. Wolf will talk more about that relative to our budget request. And then last and certainly not least, we do set rates, and that's sort of the traditional function, I think, associated with the Public Utilities Commission. There has been a big increase in the number of rate cases, and I think that's caused by several factors. One is certainly that we do see that there is aging infrastructure, and that as a result we do have to be replacing the infrastructure that's currently there, that there is an increased demand by customers and by state policy for renewable energy. Also, because in the past, new infrastructure was paid by growing demand for electricity. We're no longer facing that situation because we've had very effective energy efficiency policies. And even though the economy of the state is growing, we have very flat growth in new electric demand. And as a result, we have to figure out more creative ways to assure that there's sufficient funds to pay for the changes that we want to make in the system. As a result, our rate cases are big, they're complex. We evaluate all of the utility costs, both typical and atypical. By typical, I mean their operation and maintenance, what their investment in plant is and their depreciation, their capital structure and so forth. And then more atypical, like if, for example, there's a turbine that has a big accident, as Sherco did, what are the costs for bringing it back? Whose fault was the turbine failure? Who should be bearing the responsibility for those? Or we had a big cost overrun at the Monticello plant. We actually, along with the Department of Commerce, hired an outside nuclear expert to try to evaluate why there were those cost overruns, how many of them were caused by changes in the federal laws post-Fukushima, how many were necessary in order to increase the capacity of Monticello, and then perhaps were there any maintenance issues or others where they misjudged what the costs were going to be. So all of that goes into the rate cases, and you'll see from this slide here that over the last 5 years, we've had 13 rate cases filed with us, 5 natural gas, 8 electric cases. The increases that were requested in those cases equaled $638.73 million. After the complete contested case review by all of the parties, which includes the Department of Commerce and groups of ratepayers, ultimately the commission allowed an increase of about $308 million. So you can see that's a large difference, and that's a great deal of what we do in the rate cases is to try to scrutinize the costs that the utilities are requesting and to determine what is prudent on behalf of the ratepayers. We do, as you'll see here, have yet one more Xcel rate case pending along with Dakota Electric. Let me just make a little footnote about Dakota Electric. It's a co-op. It's not required to have its rates set by us, but its board has chosen to do that, to follow the process that the Public Utilities Commission uses and to pay the commission and the process rather than do it by their own board of directors as their co-op business has become increasingly complex. So as I know that Mr. Wolf will emphasize to you, we operate with a very dedicated staff of accountants and financial experts and engineers, and they are truly very dedicated to the work we do. I only wish we could compensate them more. We are regulating a field of endeavor for that has $6.5 billion a year in revenue, and so we assess them for our charges, and it's all paid back to the general fund. So although we do seek an appropriation from you, and are glad for it to pay our staff, that money is all returned to the general fund, as will be discussed in a little greater detail. So if there are no additional questions for me, I will turn this over to Mr. Wolf to talk a little bit more about the specifics of the budget.
We have one more question, and then we'll move on to Mr. Wolf's presentation. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair, for your presentation today. I'm one of the new members over here, and as I see and have heard many presentations from folks through my office and understanding the bigger picture, I formerly sat on the Wilmer Municipal Utilities back in Wilmer, so I do understand your role and how well it's played, and I also see the complex journey that IOUs performed to go to you for a rate increase. From your seat and from your level, you see as time goes on and you've got same companies coming back to you with, for the most part, a request for increases, and I see you do your due diligence. Do you see as time goes on with same companies and things that we're able to streamline the complexities of those rate requests? You know, it all turns back to the rate payers anyway. Do you see, still doing your due diligence and getting the right information, do you see ways that those can be less loaded with opinions and attorneys and things that can help the still doing the due diligence, but as time goes on with same companies again in history, does that get better and faster as time goes on, or is it actually getting slower and more cumbersome with more regulation? And your opinion on that?
Good question, Commissioner.
That is a good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I don't know, and that's a fact. These cases do not seem to get either repetitive or simpler. Partly, I think there's a lot of money at stake, and so we do expect the utilities to provide a great deal of detail. We have set some limits in statute, for example, on executive compensation, promotional activities, publicity, and so forth. We've, both through statute and through commission order, we've set some caps on those to take out of the equation a lot of haggling about, you know, how much should the CEO of Xcel be paid. But to the extent that they are seeking new investment in infrastructure, changes in circumstances, every time we look at this, we have to re-examine what do we anticipate their pension funds are going to earn over the coming time period, and how much should that be discounted. There's lots of questions, even the return on equity. Every time we go through a rate case, we are evaluating, well, in this time period, what's an appropriate return on equity for this business, which it's not guaranteed to them, but it's built into the rate, so they have the opportunity to earn it. Those take up, well, and let me mention one other thing. Each time we also look at all of their costs and how should they be allocated to the classes of ratepayers, which costs can easily be allocated to residential customers, commercial, industrial. Huge amount of argument over that, and that is true in each rate case, and again, because there's a lot of money at stake. So we actually, in this past 2 years, requested assistance from the National Regulatory Assistance Project, which is an arm of NARUC, our national organization, to come in and look at our rate process to see if there were ways in which we could streamline it. And honestly, we didn't get a lot of help. We've also tried to look at what other states do to see if there are other models that might make more sense here. Pros and cons, I would say. So I wish I had an easy answer for that question. I will say it's so staff intensive that we are always looking for ways to figure out are there charts or graphs or information they could pre-file that would make our review go more easily, either for us or for the Department of Commerce, other changes we might make that could speed it up. I will say, by statute, we're required to review and approve a rate increase within a year, and if we don't, they automatically get it. So pressure's on us to make sure that we do our due diligence and keep the process moving.
Representative Baker.
And thank you. Final question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Madam, I was hoping that there were some other states that you could compare yourself to. I guess I was also maybe just more hoping that our PUC will look at themselves as comparing to other states and how they quickly turn it around, what's an average timeline to make those kind of decisions. I believe most states are probably doing their due diligence as well. So I just hope that we are constantly comparing ourselves to what we are requiring our companies to do as well as others, and we can always find the best way to find the quickest, most efficient manner to give that good information to the utilities and to our customers. So appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Mr. Wolf, if you would briefly want to cover the change documents, and then we'll be on to the PFA.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As the chair said, Dan Wolf, Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission. The committee's jurisdiction is both policy and budget, so we wanted to talk a little bit about who we are and how we operate, as well as some major issues before us, and now we'll talk a little bit about our budget and obviously be respectful of your time and agenda today. So first, a little bit of a discussion about where we are and then where the governor has recommended that we go, and identify a couple of those change items. So the current biennium, fiscal years 2014 to 15, I'll focus on the smaller piece of that pie first. 30% of our operating budget is actually special revenue, and that really is dollars in, dollars out. So those are the sorts of things where there are activities that assist us in the work that we do. We collect fees for that, but it's just turned around and paid to other entities to affect those programs. So typical expenses there would be, the biggest one is going to be the administrative law judge expenses. So when we refer matters over to the Office of Administrative Hearings, we get billed for that time, and we collect that and pay it back to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Another large dollar grouping in there would be the TAP, Telephone Assistance Plan Administration, the grants, again, assessment on the telecom providers, dollars in but dollars back out to those who need that assistance. The bigger piece of the pie there, the 70%, is the general fund dollars. And we need a general fund appropriation because we need, A, the authority to spend, and then, B, the dollars to spend. So we do need that general fund appropriation, but then the point that the chair already mentioned and we want to emphasize is that those dollars are then assessed back to the customers that we're serving and collected on behalf of the state. So there's no net impact to the general fund for those expenses. Calling back to the, you know, my life experience more than a few years ago in private practice of law, I like to make the analogy that it's like a law firm. We have the clients, we do the work for the clients. We as the law firm need to upfront those expenses to pay the staff, the attorneys in the law firm to do that work and pay our own expenses. But then as we bill the clients back, we collect those dollars back. So we need those general fund dollars at the start of the process to have the authority to spend and then to be able to spend that. But we do collect those back in assessments to the utilities and telecom providers that we serve. So as I said, there's no net impact to the general fund for those dollars. Certainly we're sensitive to ratepayers ultimately are going to pay those expenses, and we want to be judicious with the use of those dollars. But in terms of the budget impact, it is recovered. Moving on to where we are going in terms of the governor's recommendations. For FY 2016 and 2017, the dollars are in millions here for simplicity of the chart. Again, the general fund dollars that I just talked about, the base amount is going into this upcoming biennium is the $12.446 million. That actually is $452,000 less than our current fiscal 14-15 budget. The reason that base is actually that $452,000 less is because there was a one-time appropriation in the 2013 legislation because of the rulemaking that was required of the Commission for the Distributive Generation proceedings, and we had to make changes to the rules to conform to the statutory changes. So that's an ongoing process. There was some dollars provided for that rulemaking proceeding, recognizing that that was necessary by the legislation, and it's not built into the ongoing base. So it's actually a little bit smaller than what we're operating on today. The two change items that we identified to the administration and the governor has recommended, I have identified there. And the first one is $400,000 as an operating increase. As you've already heard and you will hear from other agencies, there is certainly an increase in the cost of operating the organization. And particularly for us, we're a small agency. We only have 50 employees, staff level, and then the five commissioners, so 55 total. And obviously when you have that size of an agency and when you do the work that we do, almost all of your operating funds are going to be the salary component. And so to the extent that we have had negotiated increases that have been approved by the legislature in the salary structure for the staff, obviously we comply with that, but that has an impact going forward. We did not make any assumptions going forward what those negotiated settlements might be, because number one, they have to be negotiated. Number two, they have to be approved by the administration. And three, they have to be approved by the legislature. So there was no assumption built in going forward on any of those dollars, but merely trying to make us whole for the expenses that we've already incurred in the current biennium. And then the enhanced decision-making process that we identified, and I know you have the budget materials from the governor's recommendations, and that particular item is 5 pages long, so I won't go into all the detail on that.
Thank you.
Yes. But we did identify a little over $1 million increase for the biennium. We've identified 5 FTEs that would go with that particular budget change item. And as the chair identified, we believe there's a very strong case to be made there. The filings that we're receiving becoming more frequent. The rate cases that we're involved in are much larger in scale in terms of the dollars and in terms of the impact. They're much more complex. When you look at the activities that need to be coordinated on a regional level and a national level, all of those things just make the work of the staff much more complex, much more challenging. And in order to accomplish all the things that the legislature is asking us to do, we believe it would be appropriate to increase our staff complement. Again, given the fact that it's a small agency, all of that workload just has a tremendous impact on the people that are there.
So, Mr. Wolf, with that, I think we're going to leave your comments at that, because we do want to hear from the PFA today.
Yep.
So, as always, thank you very much for taking the time. I assume you'll be continuous dialogue with members of the committee as we go forward, and we look forward to seeing you guys again. So, thanks again for coming by. Public Facilities Authority, come on down. Yep. And members, you have your you have the budget changes and the budget narrative with you. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the executive director of the Public Facilities Authority. I don't have any PowerPoint slides. I think in your packets you should have a PFA handout that I will go through pretty quickly, and then be happy to take any questions. The Public Facilities Authority is a multi-agency financing authority. We provide financing primarily for local governments for wastewater and drinking water infrastructure projects, as well as some stormwater, some transportation, but primarily wastewater and drinking water. The PFA is governed by a board that consists of 6 state agency commissioners that representing the departments of Employment and Economic Development, Health, Agriculture, Transportation, Pollution Control Agency, and Management and Budget. PFA manages 3 revolving loan funds and several other state grant and loan programs in conjunction with our various member agencies. The PFA member agencies and departments set project priorities, conduct the technical review of projects. PFA staff do credit review of the cities and the funding applications, set the loan terms and conditions, services the loans, handle the financial side of the programs. The PFA receives federal and state matching funds to capitalize our revolving loan programs. And then also we have authority to sell up to $1.5 billion in tax-exempt revenue bonds. PFA revenue bonds are rated AAA by all 3 credit rating agencies. These are bonds that are paid strictly from loan repayments and investment earnings. There's no state backing to PFA revenue bonds. PFA receives no state general funds for administration. Our administrative funds come primarily from fees on the loan repayments that we collect as they come back in. On the second page, there's a diagram that just kind of illustrates the structure of the PFA with the 6 different agencies and departments and the various programs that we administer with those member agencies. And then we've got a review just quickly of our programs, starting with the clean water programs. And the base programs there for clean water are Clean Water Revolving Fund, which provides low-interest loans to cities and other local units of government for wastewater treatment facilities, sewer collection systems, those various kinds of construction projects, as well as stormwater treatment facilities. Over the 25 years of this revolving fund, we've made a total of 495 loans to date for about $2.7 billion. And because these are low-interest loans made at below-market interest rates, our estimated interest savings to the local governments and taxpayers from those loans is about $645 million. The programs operate with an annual federal capitalization grant and then a 20% state match that comes through typically through state general obligation bonds. We did receive 20% match funds for the next 2 years from the last bonding bill. We leveraged those funds then with our revenue bonds and loan repayments as they come back in and revolve out for new projects. So in total, over the history of the program, every $1 of state funds has generated over $14 in construction and over $3 in interest savings. Our current 2015 loan list, called the Intended Use Plan, has 109 eligible projects totaling $197 million. The PCA's five-year list of projects is right now about $1.5 billion. We also then administer the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, or the WIF program, that provides supplemental assistance grants for high-cost wastewater projects based on affordability criteria. And those grants can be provided either as a match with the USDA Rural Development, which is the federal agency that also provides loans and grants primarily for small rural communities, and we partner with them on a lot of projects. The WIF grants can also be packaged with our own Clean Water Revolving Fund loans then based on the affordability criteria to make the high-cost projects more affordable. We also administer two programs that are funded through Clean Water Legacy Funds. Point Source Implementation Grants provide 50% grants for when cities are required to do some sort of treatment system upgrade to meet more stringent requirements to address specific water quality goals. There's also the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program that focuses loan and grant funds specifically on small unsewered communities. The governor has recommended $18.5 million in the Clean Water Legacy Funds for those two programs.
Excuse me, Mr. Freeman. Excuse me, I'm sitting in for Chairman over there, Gruffalo, for a minute. Have a question regarding the clean water that I hear from our local municipals. I see over the organizational chart that you work with the PCA. I'm kind of wondering, what is your relationship with the PCA when it comes to possibly the regulations or the standards that they have, or are you just acting as more of a fiscal arm? I'm kind of curious of that relationship, if I may.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Our PCA is entirely responsible for the setting the regulations, the treatment limits, all of that. We don't get involved in that. We work closely with the PFA or the PCA primarily to look at the project priorities that they've set and the pace of projects and the status of projects that are on the list so that we can be working with those cities on the financial side to make sure that we've got the financing in place when those projects are ready to go ahead.
Thank you. Please continue.
And the note at the bottom of that page just explains further, all of these clean water programs follow the PCA's project priority list, which ranks projects based on environmental and public health criteria. Then going on to other programs, we have a drinking water revolving fund that works very similarly to the clean water program, low-interest loans to cities for construction of drinking water treatment facilities, water towers, water mains, all of that kind of infrastructure. It's only been going about 15 years compared to 25 for the clean water, so the dollars are a little smaller. 354 loans to date for $704 million. Works very similarly in terms of the annual federal capitalization grants, the state match. You can see the numbers there. Current list that we have is 99 fundable projects on the list for about $171 million. We've made some of those loans already, and others are proceeding through the final stages of design and approval. We also have a transportation revolving loan fund, much smaller than the other two. Provides low-interest loans to governmental entities for eligible transportation projects. As you can see, at 34 loans for $176 million, so much smaller. We work with the Department of Transportation. They set project priorities, select projects, and then we work with them on the financing side. Typically only one to three projects a year, usually. You can see a couple of recent loans that we've made. And then finally, at the bottom of the page, the Credit Enhancement Program, which is not a direct financing program. We simply administer that in conjunction with management and budget. And through this program, the state provides a limited guarantee of local government general obligation bonds that are issued for certain purposes, which allows those cities to get a higher bond rating and lower interest costs. The next page gives you a list of by year the total clean water revolving fund loans we've made by year, as well as the average interest rates and the interest savings that calculated for those loans. The bottom half of the page illustrates how those loans have been made throughout the state and the different regions of the state. And at the very bottom, there's a summary that identifies the total loans that we've made to, first of all, the Met Council, which provides wastewater treatment services for the metropolitan area, other metro cities, and then greater Minnesota cities. As you can see, the loan amounts are split fairly evenly between the metro and greater Minnesota. If you look over to the right, the interest savings are weighted quite a bit more to greater Minnesota communities, and that's because our interest rate structure, we provide greater discounts to the small rural or small communities that where the costs are higher, basically on a per household basis, get a lower interest rate.
Mr. Freeman, one more question I have too. You're showing a lot of the interest savings that you're providing for a lot of communities. Can you tell us also, I don't see it here, where the what interest income there has been for the state, the interest acquired?
All of the repayments, interest and principal, goes back into the revolving fund. So it's under federal law, these are revolving funds that we're responsible for maintaining in perpetuity. So all that interest earnings comes back into the fund and is available then for new loans. So I don't have the total numbers, but it's not available to the state for any other purpose.
Right, but it's not separated out in the financial presentation?
Not right
just
here.
It was separate,
isn't.
But
I do have that information. I can get that for you.
Okay. Thank you.
So the pool, just one last point on this, the pooled nature of our revolving fund with large cities, small cities, metropolitan cities, greater Minnesota cities, that diverse pool is a major factor in the AAA rating that we receive on our bonds. The rating agencies look at that diversity in the pool, and that provides strength that allows us to get that AAA rating, which gives us lower borrowing rates and then translates into lower interest rates for the communities themselves. The next page gives you that same look on the drinking water revolving fund. And in that case, actually, both the loan amounts and the interest savings are quite a bit weighted more towards greater Minnesota cities, but we do make loans to cities throughout the state, including the metro area. The bar charts on the next page just give an illustration over the last 10 years or so of the leveraging that we're able to get. The green bars are the project financing, the loans we've made by year. The blue are the federal dollars that we receive each year. The red are the state match. So you can see that with a small amount of capitalization from the federal grants and the state match, we're able to generate a lot of loan activity, a lot of construction activity, and that's because of that revolving nature where all the repayments come back in and are available to go out again. Then the next page gets into the green sheets, which members may be familiar with from past sessions. This is the Pollution Control Agency's entire project priority list. As I mentioned, it's a five-year list of projects, projects that are in various stages of readiness. Cities apply to the PCA to be placed on this list when they have a project that they're in development and they're seeking state financial assistance for. This sheet shows the projects ranked in priority order. You can see on the left side MPCA rank and MPCA points. The points are assigned based on PCA rules, the criteria that are spelled out there. Across the columns then are the various funding programs, and under the PFA section in the middle are the clean water programs that I described earlier, starting with the largest program, the Clean Water Revolving Fund Loan. The notation there is 2015 IUP fundable range, that the projects and cities with dollar amounts there are the cities that have applied and are on our current list to receive loans this year. And then you can see the other programs. There's CWRF principal forgiveness. There's a small amount of the federal funds that we're required to give out in grants, and that we use our same affordability criteria that we have for the WIF program. You can see some amounts there. The grayed lines all the way across indicate projects or funds that have been awarded, and those projects are in construction. The gray cells where our projects that are funds that have been committed under the various program rules, and those projects are in the final stages and will soon begin construction this spring. The Clean Water Revolving Fund, historically, we can't fund all of the needs. Historically, our funding cutoff has been at 45 points. This year, we actually, because of some additional capacity and lower demand in the last few years, with some of the recession that cities have been feeling, we were able to stretch that cutoff to 38 points. So you can see on, I guess it's page 6 of 8, the last city on the list for this year, City of Waverly, with a 38-point project. And then you can see the estimated WIF needs are the based on the affordability criteria that are spelled out in our statutes and the project information. Those are the grants that those projects would be eligible for, or the estimated grants, provided we have funds and the projects are ready to go. We received $18.3 million in the last bonding bill for the WIF program, and all but a few hundred thousand dollars are now committed to projects that are either already under construction or will be this spring. The there's an alphabetical list of projects behind the green sheets if you're looking for a particular city. And then when you get to the blue sheets, that's the drinking water revolving fund that, as I mentioned, works similarly. In this case, it's the health department that ranks projects based on public health criteria. And we have fewer of the additional programs, but you can see the programs that are there. And then on both lists, there's a section off to the right that says other funders. Those are the other funding agencies that we work closely with and coordinate with, primarily, or the largest one being the USDA Rural Development Program that we communicate with often and work hard to get the most from our combined funds and help cities apply and get in the process for the best program that will give them the best financial package.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. And maybe, unless we have questions now, we could go and look at your the updated changes from the governor's budget.
And I don't have the but the governor's budget, as I mentioned, has $18.5 million for our Clean Water Legacy programs. All of the other PFA revenues, the loan fees, and those are statutorily appropriated, so there's not a separate budget request for all of those. Okay.
Thank you very much. Anybody have any questions for Mr. Freeman at this time? Yes, Representative Vogel.
Just one quick one, Mr. Chair. Mr. Freeman, just curious, you've got a AAA bond rating. You're doing that with revenue bonds just because you've got so much diversity in the repayment that it works out that way?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, the volume of loans and the reserves that we have compared to the outstanding bonds, which is about $1 billion right now, provides a lot of revenue coverage to secure that AAA rating.
All right. Anything else, Mr. Vogel? All right. Any other questions? Oh. Representative, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a really quick question here. The on the project priority list, the white one, you have the priority list rankings from 2015. You've got the rank and you've got the points. Could you just give me just the thumbnail sketch? How are these cities ranked? Is there a you have a committee that you get together? You sit down, you look at these cases. How is the ranking done,
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the ranking is done by the Pollution Control Agency based on their rules. They have a point system, so it's a very objective criteria. There's a worksheet on the PCA's website that the cities, with some help from their consulting engineer, it's fairly easy to fill out. The ranking provides points based on age and condition of the current facilities, based on the treatment standards that the city is required to meet, the receiving water that they discharge to. There are a number of different criteria, but it's a very objective kind of scoring process, and then they score all of the projects and each year give the new list to us.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up question then. So as I look at the rank, the lower or the higher the number, the lower the ranking they are on that list, correct? That's
Mr.
how that
Freeman.
Works?
Correct, and that's reflected in the green sheets where the number one ranked project has 100 points.
Okay.
And then on down, there's a number of projects lower on the list that actually only have 1 point, and that's really more kind of a placeholder, and it indicates that some of the information to do the full scoring apparently hasn't been submitted yet.
Representative Neuberger. That's it. Thank you. Any other further comments? Hearing no more, thank you very much, Mr. Freeman, for your presentation today. I do want to remind the committee that we are going on a field trip on Monday over to River Center. According to our committee administrator, we'll have a bus out on the east side of the state office building, the doors facing the Capitol at 12:10 and 12:30. That'll be departing here to the River Center for that meeting. Watch for updates on your email coming up. Otherwise, with that being said, we'll have our next meeting on Monday. This meeting is adjourned.